yard. Stick it in your ear.
All right.
And now for the golden age of radio and the triumphant return of our resident producers, Jeff Ward and Doug Bost. And tonight's program is on the theme of revenge. So, you know, I worked hard last week raising thousands of dollars for WBAI, so I'm going to take a rest and enjoy the program along with you. WBAI New York, stay tuned.
Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the historic sounds of radio's bygone days. The golden age of radio rides again.
Welcome to the golden age of radio. We are Doug Bost and Jeff Ward speaking to you by transcription over the airwaves of WBAI. Filling in tonight for the great Max Schmid, who will be back next week, as always. Tonight, revenge. Ruthless payback. Spite. Vengeance. All the most beautiful aspects of human nature will be on display tonight. We are playing three stories of awful, terrible vengeance. And we're going to start with one of the great revenge stories of all time. And it is done so beautifully. We're going to hear the Mercury Theater's production of The Count of Monte Cristo.
This is from August 29th of 1938, when broadcast radio was riddled with breaking news from Europe. In fact, it starts with breaking news from Europe.
Yeah, you're going to hear it. It's great. It really kicks off with this news story about the German efforts to control Czechoslovakia right then.
This is one of the breaking news bulletins that inspired the War of the Worlds 2 months later.
So we're going to hear Orson Welles, Ray Collins, George Galouris, Edgar Barrier, Paul Stewart, and Orson Welles' wife, Virginia Welles, plays Mercedes in this, and she's credited as Anna Stafford. That was her stage name when she worked with the Mercury Theater. So now, again, from August 29th, 1938, The Count of Monte Cristo.
Here is a special bulletin from the Press Radio Bureau, Berlin. The dispute over Czechoslovakia seems to be moving closer to a head. The newspaper, which speaks for the German Foreign Office, has published a statement advising Great Britain to warn Czechoslovakia that the demands of the Sudeten Germans must be satisfied if an acute situation is to be avoided. The paper urges action right away. This bulletin is from the Press Radio Bureau. Further details will be found in your newspapers.
The Mercury Theater on the air. Columbia Broadcasting System takes pride in bringing you Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in another broadcast of the unique series which signalizes radio's first presentation of a complete theatrical producing company. For these programs, the regular member stations of the Columbia Broadcasting System are joined by the coast-to-coast network of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Tonight, the Mercury Theater turns to another of the great narratives and adventure stories of the world of literature, The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas. And here again is the director, the star, and producer of these broadcasts, Orson Welles.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. There is no reasonable explanation of Alexandre Dumas. He was a rich man. We note with interest that he went bankrupt in the theater. He was a revolutionary. His grandfather was a marquis. His grandmother was a negress. He was born as Napoleon became emperor. He died in poverty as the Germans marched into France. He wrote The Count of Monte Cristo as a newspaper serial, and shortly after the last installment, A ball and a bullfight were organized for him in Seville, and finally in Algiers, the customs men let his baggage through without examination. Such things don't and can't happen today, but then, neither does Alexandre Dumas himself, the wildest romance of a man, who could and did openly maintain at 70 numerous establishments and a literary factory as well, whose quantitative output is equaled in the arts only by Rubens' studio. There's a good story about what Dumas Père told Dumas Fils. Father, said the inventor of Camille, I have just read your latest book. Have you, my son, said Dumas Père. What's it about? I am not sure I have. It is no secret and no shame either that the Chateau Monte Cristo was haunted by many ghostwriters and that its owner signed his name to more books than anyone could ever write. It is not expected of Pharaoh that he build with his own hands his own pyramids. And the mere blueprint of one Dumas plot is an airtight alibi for a whole career. Of all these, out of question, the most gloriously complex, possibly the most impossible, a mathematical miracle, as perfect as watchworks and as big as Pittsburgh, among hundreds, one Dumas plot persists as the most ingenious tall story ever perpetrated by the mind of man. God's vengeance on radio scriptwriters and your indestructible delight in spite of us. Here then is a humble 57 minutes worth of The Count of Monte Cristo. In the year 1815, I, Edmond Dantès, was first mate of the Pharaoh, bound for Marseille from Smyrna, Trieste, and Naples. The day we left Naples, the captain was attacked by a fever and died within 3 days. On the 28th day of September, we sighted the coast of France. Some hours later, we rounded the Chateau d'If and entered Marseille Harbor. Monsieur Morel, the owner, came abroad.
Good day, Monsieur Morel.
Good day, Monsieur Danglars.
You've heard of the misfortune that's befallen us, Monsieur Morel?
Yes, yes, you mean poor Captain Leclerc. He was a brave and an honest man.
And a first-rate seaman, grown old between sky and ocean.
Well, a man needs not be old, I'm glad to know his business. Edmond Dantès, your mate there, seems to understand his thoroughly.
Hey, let go of the anchor!
You see, he fancies himself captain already.
And so, in fact, he is.
Monsieur Morel, at your service. You called me, I think.
Yes, that is. I'm told you stopped a day and a half at the Isle of Elba. Why?
I don't know, sir.
You don't know?
No, sir. It was to fulfill a last instruction of Captain Leclerc when he was dying. He gave me a packet to be delivered on the island.
Ah. You did right, dentist, to follow Captain Leclerc's instructions, though if it were known that you've delivered a packet to the island, it might get you into trouble.
How could it get me into trouble, sir, if I don't even know what it was? I was delivering. Beg your pardon, sir. Yeah, the customs officer's coming alongside.
Hey there, no other companionway.
Well, Monsieur Morel?
Yes, Monsieur Danglars?
Edmond Dantès gave you satisfactory reasons for his landing at Elba?
Oh, yes, quite satisfactory.
So much the better.
Yes, it was Captain Leclerc who gave orders for this delay.
Talking of Captain Leclerc, has Dantès given you a letter from him?
To me? No, was there one?
I believe that besides the packet, Captain Leclerc had confided a letter to his care.
Of what packet are you speaking, Danglars?
Of that which Dantès left at the Isle of Elba.
How do you know he had a packet to leave at the Isle of Elba?
I was passing close to the door of the captain's cabin, which was partly open. I saw him give the letter and the packet to Dantès.
He didn't speak to me of it, but if there was any letter, he'll give it to me. Danglars, you'll report to the office this afternoon with the bills of lading and the storage plans. Good day.
Good day, Monsieur Morel.
It's a wonderful thing to be home again after 3 months at sea, to see the places you've grown up in as a boy and the streets full of people. I found my father in the little dark room where he lived on the fourth floor of a house in the Rue du Noailly.
Father.
Oh, Edmund.
Father. What is it? Are you ill? Father, what's wrong with you?
No, no, my boy, my son, no, but I... I didn't expect you, and the joy and surprise of seeing you so
Father,
suddenly.
Father, listen to me. I'm to be captain at 20, a captain with 3,000 francs pay and a share in the profits. Isn't that more than I could have hoped for?
Yes, yes, dear boy. Much more than we could have expected.
Smart young dog, your son, eh, Dantes?
In the doorway stood our neighbor, the tailor, Caderousse.
Captain, eh? I know someone below the Church of San Michel who won't be sorry to hear about this, eh, Dantes?
Mercedes?
That's who he means, Father. And now that I know your will, your consent, I'll go to her.
Oh, go, dear boy, and heaven bless you in a wife, as it blessed me.
In a wife? How fast you go, Father Dantes. She isn't his wife yet, as far as I know.
She soon will be.
Yes, yes, but you were wise to return when you did, my boy.
Well, Caderousse, what do you mean by that?
Oh, I don't mean anything in particular. Mercedes is a very fine girl, and fine girls never lack suitors. There's one in particular, a cousin of hers, I think he is. Fernand Mondego. I've even heard it
What's
said...
that?
Oh, don't worry, my boy. Now that you're captain, who could refuse
did
you?
Did you just say that if I were not a captain...
I didn't say that, my boy. I didn't say that. No offense, man, my boy. No offense.
I went into the street, down past the Church of San Michel, into the fisherman's quarter. Mercedes! Mercedes!
Edmund, you're back.
We were in each other's arms. The burning sun of Marseille covered us with a flood of light. At first I saw nothing but her face raised to mine. The shining eyes, the eager lips. Then suddenly in the room behind us I saw the face of a young man, pale and threatening. And I saw that he had his hand on a knife at his belt.
Mercedes, who is this man?
Mercedes, I did not expect to meet an enemy here in your house.
There is no enemy. This is my cousin. We've been friends since childhood. Fernando's the man whom, after you, Edmond, I love best in the world.
Well? Give me your hand, Fernand.
Is your name Edmond Dantes?
Fernand Mondego came forward. For an instant, I saw a look of deadly hatred in his eyes. Then, quickly, without giving me his hand, he went past us and out into the street. The betrothal feast is a gay affair in the South. Monsieur Morel removed every difficulty. The papers were soon drawn up. The arrangements were simple. Mercedes had no fortune. I had none to settle on her, and the wedding was set for two. All our friends were there, and the crew of the Pharaoh and Mercedes people from among the fishermen.
The law.
Who among the persons here assembled answers to the name of Edmond Dantes?
I'm Edmond Dantes. What do you want of me?
Edmond Dantes, in the name of the law, I arrest you.
Arrest me?
We duly appointed the reason for your arrest at your first examination.
Officer, he is
what's
my
smuggled you?
He's done nothing wrong. He's a good boy.
That mistake is possible, in which case every reparation will be made.
Edmund.
Meantime, Edmond Dantes, you're under arrest.
Why?
Follow me. All attention! All!
De Vifor, here is the prisoner.
Bring him in. Wait outside.
Yes, sir.
What is your name?
Are you the king's prosecutor, sir?
Yes. Your name?
My name is Edmond Dantes.
Give all the information in your power. Have you served under the usurper, Napoleon?
No, sir.
It is reported that your political opinions are extreme.
My political opinions?
Alas, I never had any opinions. I'm hardly 19, sir.
What do you make of this, then? It is a letter, Monsieur Dantès. Well, read it.
Monsieur, the king's prosecutor is hereby informed by a friend of the throne and religion that one Edmond Dantès, mate of the ship Pharaoh, arrived this morning from Smyrna, that having touched at Naples and the island of Elba, he's been entrusted by the usurper with a letter for the Bonapartist committee in Paris. Proof of this crime will be found on arresting him, for the letter will be found on his person or at his father's or in his cabin on board the Pharaoh. I'm sorry, sir, I don't understand it.
Do you know the writing?
No, sir.
Whoever did it writes well. Have you any enemies?
Not that I know of, sir.
Now answer me frankly. Not as a prisoner to a judge, but as one man to another. Is there any truth in this accusation?
Not at all, sir. I swear by my honor as a sailor. Then I told him my story. I told him how Captain Leclerc on his deathbed had entrusted a packet to me and told me with his dying breath to deliver it to the island of Elba.
What did you do then?
What should I have done, monsieur? What every man would have done in my place. I sailed for the island of Elba, I delivered the packet, and was given in return a letter to be delivered to a man here in Marseille. I did it because it was what my captain had told me to do. I landed here yesterday, that is all, sir.
I see. Well, that sounds like the truth. Now, give up this letter you have brought from Elba. Give us your word that you will appear if you're called, and go back to your friends.
I'm free then, sir?
Yes. But first, give me this letter.
Here you are, sir.
Very well. By the way, to whom were you to deliver this letter?
To Francois Noirtier of this city.
Francois Noirtier?
Yes, sir. Why, do you know this man?
A faithful servant of the king does not know conspirators. Have you shown this letter to anyone?
To no one, sir, on my honor.
Nobody knows that you are the bearer of a letter from the Isle of Elba addressed to Francois Noirtier?
Nobody, sir, except the person who gave it to me. Why, sir? What's the matter? What's the matter, sir?
You give me your word of honor that you are ignorant of the contents of this letter.
My word of honor, sir, but what's the matter? You're ill, sir. Shall I call for help?
No, stay where you are. It is for me to give orders here, not you. I'm sorry. I am no longer able, as I had hoped, to restore you to liberty. Before doing so, there are formalities to be gone through. I'll try to make them as short as possible. The principal charge against you, as you know, is this letter. And you see what I do with it. You see? I destroy it.
Oh, Monsieur de Villefort. Your goodness itself.
Now then. Do you trust me?
Order me, sir. I'll obey.
Listen. This is not an order, but advice that I give you.
Yes, monsieur.
I shall keep you until this evening here in the Palais de Justice.
Yes, sir.
Should anyone else question you, don't breathe a word of this letter.
I promise.
You see, the letter is destroyed. You and I alone know of its existence. So if they question you about it, deny all knowledge of it.
I will, sir.
It was the only letter you had.
It was.
Swear it.
I swear.
Did you ring, monsieur?
A guard entered. Villefort whispered something in his ear, to which he replied by a motion of his head.
Follow this man, Monsieur Dantès. He has his orders.
Taken to a cell. Presently it grew dark. Hours later, I heard steps coming along the corridor. By the torches they carried, I saw the glittering sabers and carbines of four gendarmes.
Edmond Dantès.
Have you come to fetch me?
Yes.
By the orders of the king's prosecutor?
I believe so. Come with us.
Is this carriage for me?
It is for you. Get in. Get on board.
off there!
I sat in the stern sheets with a guard on each side of me in the little boat. Of the port at night. It was lowered. Soon we were outside the harbor. My first feeling was one of joy at breathing the fine sea air again, then of sadness as I saw the lights of La Reserve away to the left of me and heard the sound of voices and music coming through the open windows. Now we had passed the Tête de Mort. We were in front of the lighthouse. We were about to double the battery. Where are you taking me?
You'll soon know.
But I want to know...
We are forbidden to give you any information.
Now we had left the Isle Rotonneau where the lighthouses stood, and we were going past the fisherman's quarter. A few lights were visible from the water. If I cried out, perhaps Mercedes might hear me. I remained silent, my eyes fixed on the lights. The boat went on, and presently a rising ground hid the lights. Then I saw that we were out to sea. Comrades! For the love of God, tell me where we're going.
You're a native of Marseille and a sailor, and yet you don't know where you're going.
I have no idea.
Well, unless you're blind or have never been outside the harbor, you must know.
No!
Look around you.
Then suddenly, within 100 yards of me in the night, I saw a dark, frowning rock with a tower on it, like a great black scaffold. The Chateau d'If!
Quite right, my friend. The Chateau d'If.
Help! Help! Let me go! Help! 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 I'm innocent! I'm innocent! I'm innocent! I'm innocent!
Dantès, haven't you slept?
I don't know.
Are you hungry?
I don't know.
Do you want anything?
I want to see the governor. The governor. I'm innocent. I'm innocent. I'm innocent! Another day, another eternity. I threw out my food onto the floor. I walked round and round the narrow cell like a wild beast in its cage. I tore up the straw of my mattress.
Dantès! Well, are you reasonable today?
I want to see the governor.
I've told you that's impossible.
Why is it impossible?
It's not allowed.
I want to see the governor.
Take my advice, my friend. Don't brood over what's impossible. You'll go out of your head.
You think so?
We had an instance of it here in this cell. The priest who was here before you. He kept offering the governor £1,000,000 for his freedom. In the end, he went out of his head.
When was he in this cell?
2 years ago.
Was he set free?
No. He was put in a dungeon.
Listen to me. I want to see the governor. If you don't let me see the governor someday, I'll hide behind the door. And when you come in, I'll dash your brains out with a stool.
That's, eh? Hey, put that stool down.
Are you going to let me see the governor?
Put it down. Put that stool down. Put it down.
Well, do I see the governor?
Yes, yes, yes. You shall see the governor at once.
That's better. It's better. Hurry. Hurry! Presently, the jailer returned with 4 soldiers.
By the governor's orders, take the prisoner to the floor below.
The dungeon, then?
That's right. We put madmen with madmen.
You don't understand, I tell you. I tell you, I'm innocent. I'm innocent. I'm innocent. Months went by underground, foul, humid, and dark.
Every day, twice a day, morning and evening, the jailer came to my cell and put down the vile food and went away without speaking to me. My hair and nails had grown long, and my skin was white as a leper's. I'd been proud the first months. Now I began to beg. I begged to be moved from this dungeon to another. I begged to be allowed to walk about. I begged for books. Nothing was granted. I spoke to the jailer when he brought me my food. He rarely answered me. But to speak to a man, even though mute, was something. I tried to speak when alone, but the sound of my own voice terrified me. After what must have been 3 or 4 years, the governor of the Chateau d'If was transferred. The new man never troubled to learn my name. I was no longer Edmond Dantès. Number 34. I took to praying, but not as men pray in prosperity. In my prayers, I laid out every action of my life before the Almighty. Still, I remained a prisoner. Then a deep gloom took possession of me, and then furious rage and savage thoughts of revenge. And wildly, I dashed myself against the walls of my prison. I tore at my own flesh with my nails, and then in the end, I began to think of dying. I swore that I would starve myself to death. So every morning and every evening, I threw out through the small grated window all the food the jailer brought me, every bit of it, at first gaily and then thoughtfully and then with regret. I held the plate in my hand for an hour at a time, gazing at the morsel of bad meat, of tainted fish, of black and moldy bread. Then I remembered my oath and threw the dish away. One day, I found I had not sufficient force to throw my supper out of the window. The next morning, I could hardly see or hear. I knew I was dying. The day went by. I felt a sort of stupor creeping over me. The gnawing pain at my stomach had ceased. My thirst had abated. When I closed my eyes, I saw myriads of lights dancing before them. I was on the edge of that mysterious country called death. Suddenly, a little after dark, I heard a hollow sound in the wall against which I was lying. I sat up and listened. It was a continual scratching, as if made by a huge claw or some iron instrument scraping against the stones. Then all was silent. Soon afterwards it began again, nearer and more distinct. Perhaps it was only a workman repairing a neighboring dungeon. I would soon find out. Continued. With my earthenware jug, I knocked against the wall where the sound came. Passed. 3 long days. And never a sound. At last, on the fourth evening, whoever it was quite close to me now. I wanted desperately to help him. But I had nothing, no knife or sharp instrument. I smashed my earthenware jug. That night, I moved my bed out from the wall and started to scrape the plaster with a piece from my broken jug. Soon the fragments of plaster began to fall away. In 3 days, I uncovered a large stone. The next day, about noon, the stone began to move.
Oh, my God, my God, you'll fail me now. Oh, my God.
Who talks of God in this place?
Speak again. In the name of heaven, speak.
Who are you?
A prisoner.
Of what country?
A Frenchman.
Your name?
Edmond Dantès.
How long have you been here?
Since the 28th day of February, 1815.
Your crime?
I'm innocent. And you? Who are you?
I am number 27.
How long have you been here?
Since 1804. 20 years.
All that night we worked. Then, just before dawn, a portion of the floor in my cell gave away. And from the bottom of this passage, the depth of which it was impossible to measure, appeared the head, then the shoulders, and lastly the body of a man. To this man, I owe all that I possess, all that I know, all that I've become. In the prison, he was known as the Mad Priest. I never learned his name. For 8 years, we saw each other every day, using the tunnel he had dug through the solid rock, concealing the mouth of the passage with stones carefully fitted in place. By the sundial he had traced on the wall of his cell, we knew the hours of the guard's visit. The rest of the day we were together. He had been a great scholar in his day, and all that he knew, he taught me with infinite loving patience, day after day, year after year. Then, one morning when I went down, I found him standing in the middle of his cell, pale as death.
Quick, Dantès, quick. Listen to what I have to say.
What is it, Father? Tell me. I beseech you. What's the matter?
I am dying. Help me to my bed. See, half my body is paralyzed already.
Here, Father.
Thank you, my son. Now listen to me. All is over with me. This night or tomorrow, I shall be dead.
But, Father...
I know the illness. There is no hope. And I shall never leave this place now. Before I die, there's something I want to give you.
In his hand, he held a morsel of paper tightly rolled together. A half-burned paper on which were some lines of Gothic character, traced with a peculiar kind of ink.
This paper, my child, is my treasure. From this day forth, it belongs to you.
Your treasure?
Oh, yes. I know what's passing through your mind at this moment. Even now, you, like all the others. But be assured, my child, I am not mad. This treasure exists. Read what it says.
This treasure, which may amount to declare April 14th.
See?
I see nothing but broken lines and unconnected words.
Yes. To you who read them for the first time. But to me, who have grown pale over them by many nights' study, who have reconstructed every phrase, completed every thought. Have you ever heard of the great Spada treasure?
I've heard sailors talk of it, yes.
I worked for the House of Spada. That paper is what is left of the will of Cardinal Spada, murdered by Roderick Borgia. Now, take this and put the two pieces together and read.
The 25th day of April, 1498, being invited to dine by His Holiness Alexander VI, and fearing for my life, I declare to my nephew Guido Spada, my sole heir, that I have buried in a place he knows, in the caves of the island of Monte Cristo, all I possessed of ingots, gold, money, jewels, and diamonds, which treasure may amount to nearly 2 million of Roman crowns, which you will find in the farthest angle of the island cave, And this treasure I bequeath and leave entire to him as my sole heir. Rodrigo Spada. 10 million crowns.
Yes. 100 million francs of our money. Think of the good a man could do in the world with 100 million francs.
Yes.
Now, I am dying. With my dying breath, I leave this treasure to you. Pray God you'll be more fortunate than I.
But I have no right to it, sir.
You are my son, Dantes. You are the child that God sent to console me in my captivity.
Later, in fearful agony, he died. I closed his eyes and laid him out to rest as well as I could. That night, the governor of the prison came down to look at the body.
Well, the madman's gone to look after his treasure.
With all his millions, he hasn't enough to pay for a shroud, eh? Is the iron heated?
Yes, sir.
Apply it to the soles of his feet.
From where I stood in the secret passage, I could smell the sickening odor of burnt flesh.
He's dead, all right. Poor devil. He was a priest. Get him the newest sack you can...
What time shall we bury him, sir?
The usual.
When the cell was empty again, I went in. On the bed at full length. And faintly lighted by the light of a single candle was visible a sack of coarse cloth. In it was stretched a long and stiffened form. I unlaced the sack, drew the corpse out and carried it through the tunnel to my cell. I laid it on my bed, turned the head to the wall, and covered it with a sheet. For the last time, I kissed the ice-cold brow. Then I went back to the dead man's cell.
Here's a job I can do now. Grant, you are cold as the devil up there in that
clearing. I could hear steps in the passage as the guards came down with a stretcher. Quickly, I laced up the sack around my body. I lay stiff, hoping they would not hear the beating of my heart.
Here we go. You take the head, and I'll take the feet.
He's heavy enough for an old man.
They say every year adds 0.5 pound to the bones.
Well, forward march. Careful, sir.
Steady, while I open this door.
Lord, it's cold up here.
Yeah, pleasant morning for a dip in the ocean.
A bit chilly, I'd say.
Have you got the weight?
Here it is.
Tie it on, round his feet. That's right. Tight.
See if you can do it any tighter.
Yeah, that's all right. That'll sink him.
All right now. Are you ready? One. Two.
Hey, wait a minute. Get nearer to the edge. The last one was mashed on a rock. We got the blame for it.
All right, then. Come on, I'm freezing it. Ready? Let's go. One. Two. Three.
You are listening to the CBS presentation of Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the Air, in Alexander Dumas' Count of Monte Cristo. The performance will continue in just a moment. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System. We continue now with the Count of Monte Cristo, starring Orson Welles with the Mercury Theater on the air.
In September 1834, there arrived in Marseille a man of about 38 or 40, of a pallor that was almost livid. He gave the impression of a man who had been enclosed for a long time in a tomb. soon after landing, he inquired for a man by the name of Dantes. And hearing that he'd been dead for the past 14 years, he asked for a tailor called Caderousse. Are you Gaspard Caderousse?
I am.
Let's go inside, my friend. I have to talk to you.
Well, what is it?
Monsieur Caderousse, in the year 1814 or 15, did you know a young sailor by the name of Dantes?
Dantes? Yes. Why do you ask? Is he alive?
No, he died in prison.
Died, eh? What did he die of?
What do young, strong men usually die of in prison? He died of sorrow and a broken heart. And before he died, he begged me to clear his name. He gave me the names of the people here in Marseille who had been his friends. There are three, he said, besides my father and the girl I was betrothed to. One of them is Caderousse.
He said that?
The second is Danglars.
Danglars?
The third is Fernand Mondego.
Mondego?
You know these men?
Know them? Where in heaven's name have you been, my friend? There isn't a man in France who doesn't know them. Danglars is a millionaire, has a banking house of his own. Baron Danglars, he calls himself now. And Mondego's a count and a cabinet minister and an officer of the Legion of Honor with a house in Paris a block wide. I could tell you something about these two. Not that it'll do much good now that he's dead.
Who?
That young fellow you were talking about, Dantes. I've a good mind to tell you anyway. Do you know who sent Edmond Dantes to prison? Well, I do. It was two men who were jealous of him. One for love and one for ambition. And do you know who they were? I'll tell you. Mondego and Danglars.
I thought they were his friends.
That's what he thought.
What did they do?
They denounced him to the police as a traitor.
And was he a traitor?
No more than you or I.
Which of the two denounced him?
Both, monsieur. It was Danglars who wrote the letter, and Mondego who put it in the post.
When was this letter written?
At La Réserve, the night before the wedding.
How do you know? Were you there?
I was at the next table. They thought I was too drunk to hear.
I see. How about this girl Dantes was betrothed to?
Mercedes?
Yes. Yes, that's her name. What happened to her?
Well, sir, that's a sad story. When Dantes was arrested, she was nearly mad with grief. Pitiful it was. 6 months went by and there was no news of him. And every day there was her mother telling her he was dead and telling her to marry Mondego. She came to see old Dantes. Edmund is dead, he said to her. If he weren't, he would have returned to us. Then the old man died, and that left her quite alone. Still, she waited, and still no word from him. Then, in the end, after a year, she married Mondego. And now she's one of the greatest ladies in Paris.
A year. She waited a year.
What did you say?
Nothing. Nothing. You say Edmond Dantes' father died?
Yes. Soon after his son disappeared.
What did he die of?
If you ask me, he died of starvation.
Starvation?
The doctor had another name for it, and I know better. He locked himself up in his room and died of starvation.
Day, the stranger appeared at the Palais de Justice and asked to see the prison records for the year 1815. He obtained permission to go through the case of a certain Edmond Dantes, imprisoned that year and subsequently reported as dead. He found everything arranged in due order, the denunciation, examination, and the magistrate's marginal notes. He read the examination and noted with surprise that the name of Francois Noirtier, to whom the fatal letter had been addressed, never once appeared in it. There was a notation in the margin which read as follows: Edmond Dantès, an inveterate criminal, to be kept in complete solitary confinement and to be strictly watched and guarded. It was signed De Villefort. Below, in another hand, was written: prisoner killed while attempting to escape. That night, the stranger left Marseille, going north. Villefort, Mondego, Dangla, find out everything there is to know about them. Every move they've made. Every word they've said. Every line they've written.
Yes, sir.
Find out about their homes, their wives, their children, their friends.
Yes, sir.
Find out where they got their power, how they made their money, whom they robbed, whom they cheated, whom they murdered. One day in November, Baron Dangler, head of the banking house of that name, received a visit from a new client. Monsieur le Baron Dangler.
I have the honor of addressing the Count of Monte Cristo.
You have, sir.
Have you been in Paris long, sir?
Since this morning.
I have a letter here, sir, from the firm of Thompson and French in Rome. A letter of credit in your name.
Good. And I take it that beginning today, my checks will be duly honored by your house.
In this letter, sir, there is one thing not quite clear.
Indeed.
According to this letter, the Count of Monte Cristo is to have unlimited credit on our house.
And what is there in that simple fact that requires explanation?
Merely the term unlimited.
Are you suggesting that Thompson and French are not looked upon as solvent bankers?
No. It was not their solvency that I spoke of.
I see.
But the word unlimited in financial affairs is so extremely vague a term.
To me, Baron, the word means exactly what it says. It means without limitation.
I assure you, sir, that up to the amount of a million...
I beg your pardon.
I said that should you be hard-pressed, were you even to require a million...
A million? My dear sir, for a trifle like that, I assure you, I should never have troubled to open an account. 1,000,000 francs. Excuse my smiling when you speak of a sum that I am in the habit of carrying in my pocketbook.
I admit I am hardly...
If you would prefer not to handle this account, Baron Dangler, I have letters similar to yours addressed to Baring of London and Rothschild of the city. You need have no scruples in declining.
I assure you I never...
No. No, you merely wish to be convinced that your stockholders ran no risk, nothing more. Very sound, Baron Dangler. I understand they include some of the greatest names in France. Am I right? The Duke de Mondego? The Baron de Villefort?
It is not generally known that these gentlemen...
Of course. Now we understand one another. I should like to draw tomorrow the sum of, shall we say, 6,000,000 francs, half gold, half notes.
6,000,000 francs? As you say, sir.
If I should require more, I should let you know. Oh, by the way, Baron Dangler, buy for me tomorrow 10,000 shares of Austrian Commonwealth.
You have some information, sir, about this stock?
You will find, sir, that I never gamble, except in certainties. We'll be right back. intrigued than it was that winter by the mysterious Count de Monte Cristo. Of his title, nothing was known save that he derived it from a small uninhabited island off the coast of Corsica. The source of his fortune was equally obscure, yet his wealth seemed inexhaustible. The paintings in his house in the Champs-Élysées were valued at 3 million francs, and it was known that for his carriage wheels alone he had paid 1 million francs, yet far from diminishing. By the middle of December, successful speculation had increased his deposit at Danglars Bank from 4 to nearly 6 million francs. At the end of December, a ball was given by the Count and Countess de Mondego.
Present the most talked of man in Paris, the Count of Monte Cristo, Countess de Mondego.
I am deeply honored.
What is it, Mercedes? What is it? Are you ill?
It's nothing, Clement. Perhaps the heat of this room. It was kind of you to come, sir. Will you give me your arm, Count de Monte Cristo?
I am honored, madame.
Is it true, Count, what everyone is saying about you in Paris, that you've seen so much, traveled so far, and suffered so deeply?
I have suffered deeply, madame. But
now you are happy?
No doubt, since no one hears me complain.
And your present happiness, has it softened your heart?
My present happiness does not equal my past misery.
Are you not married?
I married. No, madame.
You are alone, then?
I am alone.
You have no sister, no father?
I have none.
How can you exist thus without anyone to hold you to life?
Madame, long ago, I loved a girl. I was on the point of marrying her, madame, when we were separated. I thought she loved me well enough to wait for me, and even to remain faithful to my grave. When I returned, she was married. Perhaps my heart was weaker than that of most, and I suffered more than they would have in my place. It's all, madame.
And you are still, you've still preserved this love in your heart. It is true, one can love only once. Did you ever see her again?
Never.
And you have forgiven her for all she has made you suffer?
Yes, I have forgiven her.
But only her? Do you still hate those who separated you? You still want to punish them?
They will be punished, madame. But it is not I who will punish them. It is their own past.
Mondego.
What have you found out about these men? Danglars.
Danglars, native of Marseille. Banker, 3 times bankrupt. Convicted of using charity funds.
Yes.
Recently suspected of plunging heavily with borrowed funds.
Villefort,
native of Marseille. Formerly King's agent in that city, where he acted as Bonaparte's spy under the name of François Noirtier.
Noirtier.
Known to accept bribes. At present, prosecutor general of King's Court. Said to speculate heavily with Danglars' bank.
Mondego,
native of Marseille. Dismissed from naval service for theft. Tried for murder, 1816. Deserted French army, 1824. 1828, betrayed Ali Pasha to Turks for 2 million piastres. Believed involved heavy losses, Danglars Bank.
Monsieur Danglars.
He's in the private office, Baron de Villefort.
Good morning.
morning, Villefort.
Hello, Mondego.
You're late, Villefort.
What is it, Danglars? You sent for me in court. I hope it's something good this time. We need it.
Just arrived. A private message to the Count of Monte Cristo from Thompson and French, Rome. They've never been wrong yet.
Did he know you intercept his messages, Danglars?
Who cares?
What does it say? Read it.
Secret treaty signed tonight. Anglo-Italian due sharp rise. Buy all available shares, Thompson and French.
Well?
We are going to buy.
Danglars, I'm worried. Everything you've touched has gone wrong lately. Those Belgian bonds, we lost $500,000 on them.
Whose fault was that? On whose information?
Can I have a Danglars if the government changes its mind?
Gentlemen, gentlemen.
Our situation is desperate. We've got to plunge. Things have been going badly lately. We have no choice. If it weren't for Monte Cristo's deposits, we'd been bankrupt 3 weeks ago. If that money should be called today or tomorrow or the next day, this bank is ruined.
Danglars, I don't see what that has to do with us.
Oh, you don't you? If I go, you go. Make no mistake about that.
Gentlemen.
What do you propose to do about it, Danglars?
It's our only chance to get out. I propose to buy every share of Anglo-Italian that comes into this market.
With what?
You forget, gentlemen. The Count of Monte Cristo has 6 million francs deposited in this bank.
And what about this message? Does Monte Cristo get to see it?
This message, gentlemen, was lost in transmission.
Shares of Anglo-Italian. 110. 100 and 10. 500 and 10. 500 and 10. 100 and 15. 100 and 25. 300 shares at 150. 100 shares of Anglo-Italian. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160. 160.
don't know. I couldn't find out. Come in. Well, well, what is it?
The Count of Monte Cristo to see you, sir.
Tell him I'm not...
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I hope I don't intrude. Danglars? De Villefort? Mondego? How fortunate. Gentlemen, I'm here to say goodbye.
Goodbye?
I have decided to leave Paris for a while. Perhaps forever. Before I go, there are certain things I have left to do. Monsieur Danglars, I am in need of money for my journey. My credit on your books as of tonight is 6 million francs. Less about 1 million to cover certain stocks I sold short today. Here is a check for 5 million francs made out to cash. My carriage is outside. I'll take half in notes, half in gold.
But surely...
I beg your pardon?
Surely, sir, such a very large sum. If you could conveniently wait for this money for 24 or for the most... 48
I told
hours.
You. Baron Danglars, I'm leaving Paris tonight. Oh, by the way, Baron, you may be interested to learn. Less than an hour ago, Anglo-Italian went into liquidation. At this moment, that stock is worth less than the paper on which it's printed.
But the message from Thompson and French...
That message was sent on my instructions 3 days ago. You see, gentlemen, I own Thompson and French.
It is not true that the treaty...
As far as I know, Mondego, there never was any question of a treaty.
But it means...
It means that you three gentlemen are ruined. It means that you, Danglars, have robbed the poor and the helpless for the last time.
I'll prosecute you for this. I'll issue a warrant for your arrest.
I don't think you will, Baron de Villefort. In the first place, that message was addressed to me. In the second place, since noon today, there has been in the hands of the Minister of Justice a complete record of the career of Francois Noirtier, Baron de Villefort, spy, thief, forger, informer,
what are you?
Perjurer. Who am I? Still, you do not know? I know you very well, Fernand Mondego. And tomorrow all Paris will know you for what you are. Deserter. Traitor. Murderer.
Who are you?
What have we done to you?
You condemned me to a slow, horrible death. You killed my father. You deprived me of love, of freedom, of happiness.
Stop! In God's name, who are you?
I am the specter of a wretch you buried in the dungeons of the Chateau d'If. You guess it now, do you not? Or rather, you remember it. For notwithstanding all my sorrows and my tortures, I show you now a face which has the happiness of revenge and which is young again. A face you must often have seen in your dreams since your marriage, Mondego, with Mercedes, my betrothed. Yes, Mondego. I am Edmond Dantes.
Tonight, the Columbia Broadcasting System, through its affiliated stations coast to coast and the network of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, has brought you a performance of Alexandre Dumas' great adventure story, The Count of Monte Cristo, as dramatized in the first person singular by Orson Welles and played by the Mercury Theater on the air. In the cast this evening, Ray Collins as the Abbe Faria, George Coulouris as Monsieur Morel, Edgar Barrier as de Villefort, Eustace Wyatt as Caderousse, Paul Stewart as Old Dantes, Sidney Smith as Fernand Mondego, Richard Wilson as the officer, William Allen as a merchant, Anna Stafford as Mercedes, and Orson Welles as Edmond Dantes, the Count of Monte Cristo. The orchestra was directed by Alexander Semler, and Davidson Taylor supervised the production for CBS. Dan Seymour speaking. Next week at this same time, another great narrative brought to life by Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air. The Man Who Was Thursday by G.K. Chesterton. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Coming up next for them was The Man Who Was Thursday, but we actually played that a few months ago on the Golden Age of Radio. The audio quality on The Count of Monte Cristo is phenomenal. It just sounds, like you were saying, like it was recorded yesterday. And you don't want to, you know, he's a bad mofo.
Don't mess with Edmond Dantes.
No.
Takeaway. This is the Golden Age of Radio over WBAI, New York.
We have another story of revenge that you picked. I actually hadn't heard this play, Jeff, until you told me about it.
This is from one of my favorite late-term series called Beyond Midnight. Beyond Midnight reminds me a little bit of Quiet Please, because the audio quality is generally not great. It's from Springbok Radio in South Africa. It ran from 1968 through 1970. It has that Quiet Please quality of something that's sort of been buried and then dug up. I hope you will excuse the lack of fidelity. You won't get what you just got from the Mercury Theater.
But you will hear that song that gets in my head, just soak in biotex. And it sneaks up on me every time. I always think I can predict the just soak in biotex, but I never can. It's very frustrating.
This is from June 30th, 1969, Borneo.
And a very good evening.
Hello,
to you,
Warwick. Well, well, what'll you have?
What'll you have?
Okay, on you then. I don't mind.
Fancy somewhere a bit quieter. Like over there in the corner. Got a story to tell you.
Oh?
Remember the story about Mendingham you told me? I've got as good a one to tell you. Been hoping I'd see you. Had it straight from the filly's mouth, so to speak. The usual? Frank, double scotches, two please.
There's something ghoulish in your manner this evening, Warwick. You're going to try and scare me?
Listen and see. Ever been to Borneo. Biotex, the new soak and pre-wash powder, presents Beyond Midnight by Michael McCabe. Biotex.
If you have wondered how to get your washing really stain-free, understand this. Biotex removes the stains and dirt washing won't.
Just soak in Biotex.
Stains, grass stains, tiresome collar and cuff stains, ingrained dirt, soil and grime. Out they all come, and you don't stir a finger.
Just soak in Biotex.
Biotex with natural enzymes is the pre-wash powder with the most enzymes to give you extra pre-wash power. Absolutely no rubbing, no color loss, no fabric wear. Use it for cotton, silks, woolens, synthetics. Use it to make new again. Soaking in Biotex removes the stains and dirt that washing won't.
Just soak in Biotex.
Okay, fire away.
I'm all ears.
I won't make the obvious remark. One thing, my story, it isn't for sale. What I mean is this, it's given today free, gratis, and for nothing, friend to friend. But you don't make 200 guineas out of it by selling
it. I'm not that hard up for a yarn yet, Warwick. Carry on. Interest me. Your story?
It's a wild tale. Two planters, interior of Borneo, and as usual, there's a woman, a veritable golden-haired filly, only her mane is streaked with grey, and there's a great livid scar or weal right round her neck. She's the wife of George Thring. At the other end of the triangle is Clifford Macy. The men were partners on a small experimental estate far up in the interior. They'd been at it for 6 years and were about to reap the fruits of their labors very handsomely. And then Thring went on home leave and came back with a bride. Her name was Rona, and that was the beginning of the trouble. Macy flirted, philandered, and then fell violently in love with her.
On your bird. Don't be scared.
What bird?
Bird. Why give it a name? A bird's a bird. Tree's a tree.
No, Peter. Just... How strange. You've been here 6 years and you can't call a bird by its proper name. Is it a long-tailed cloppet or scarlet speckled ditch hopper? Have you a cigarette?
He's 45 miles away. It's all right.
All right for you.
We won't be back till tonight. We've got all the time in the world.
Peter.
Now, I ought to plug that bird, oughtn't I? He messed up our little scene. All right, relax. You're sweating. What's... Oh, sorry, madam. Perspiring. But you can see I wasn't brought up like you. Decent with tablecloths and pretty china and a vicar to tea on Sundays. Oh, Verona.
You don't do things by halves, do you? When you drink, you want to fight. When you love...
I go all out. Marry me, Rhonda.
I've already got one husband. I'm not a woman.
Oh, you know what I mean. Let's clear out.
Plantation.
The plantation can go and...
You'll be sorry tomorrow morning.
Never.
All that money. I like you, Peter.
Thanks.
And I want to be friends with you.
Look, the other night on the river, that was more than friendship, Rhonda. Yeah. Oh, the words you said then, the worlds we inhabited. Friends? Friends, yes, we were friends, but more, more. Or were you pretending, playing a game?
No. Yes, no. But, Peter, I don't know. I can't decide.
Well, that's too bad. You've got to.
Don't shout.
If I want to shout, I'll bally well shout. Are too busy sorting out their own love problems. Rhonda. Rhonda.
I want to finish my cigarette. Do you like a drink?
No, I don't want to finish your cigarette. I don't want a drink either. I want... I want...
She fell between two stools, you see. So many women of a certain type do. She began by being just friendly and kind, cheering the lonely man up, and drifted into the eternal game of all womankind, flirting. And then, well, too late she realized she couldn't put the fire out, either hers or Macy's. Thring was, in many ways, easygoing, but at the same time possessed of a curiously intense strain of jealous possessiveness. He was generous, too. If asked, he would gladly give away his last shirt or crust. But let him think or feel that his rights were being taken or curtailed, and he was a tough customer with rather primitive ideas. Macy made no attempt to hide his feelings. The woman was sitting on a volcano. For her husband, of course, became suspicious. He watched, though, with the cunning of an iguana.
Me.
All right.
Oh, rain, rain, rain. Slowed down the work on the plantation, hasn't it? Will it lose us much money?
No, not much. You're not looking well.
Looking well?
I said not looking well. You know, darling, this rain is spell. It's getting us all down. Why don't you go home for a while?
Home?
Yes, my love, home. Hampshire in June. Can't you imagine it? It's only been 18 months. Long, cool evenings on the downs, the sea at Bournemouth, concerts at Portsmouth. Oh, Jack wrote to say the Royal Philharmonic is coming.
George.
Oh, you love music, Rona. There's no chance here. Only the gramophone.
Where should you think I want to go to England? No, it's just this eternal rain. I'll be all right when it's over. Well, the rains are...
Darling, your health comes first.
Oh, my health is perfect.
You look pale. Then you...
I've never known you to be so solicitous, George. Why you...
Now, don't stay here out of duty to me, my dear.
Please. George, let's not talk about it anymore.
Ah, I see.
You see?
Borneo, the jungle. It's captivated you. Won you completely. You couldn't bear to be away from it. Is that it? England. Dreams of her rolling hills and green dells gone forever.
Well, I wouldn't put it like that. I'd like to go home one day, but...
Or is it something else?
What?
Something else that you don't wish to leave at the moment.
George, I assure you, it's merely the weather...
Or someone else. Yes, that's it. My goodness, of course. How could I have been so blind? It's someone else. My poor little Rhoda. How you must be
George,
suffering.
I'm in no mood for play acting. I'm going to bed.
Rhoda, please don't turn away. I'm talking to you. Rhoda? Rhoda, I said please do not walk away. Your husband is talking to you.
Tonight. I didn't think I'd ever...
I won't keep you long,
like
Angel, but there is something I think we ought to sort out.
Well?
My darling, I am going to ask you a question.
I have a little suspicion, you see. If I'm wrong, I shall fall upon your feet and kiss them and be your slave forever and beg your forgiveness.
George, please, what is all
that? Are you having an affair with my partner, one Peter Macy? I'm sorry, darling, did I speak too softly? Perhaps you didn't hear me.
I heard you said... George, you must be mad.
I have watched month after month. I have watched our worthy friend Macy become more openly amorous. I have seen secret glances. I have seen the way the looks that have passed
George,
between you. The looks have become less and less.
How?
Less guarded. Neither of you even care anymore. You treat me like an imbecile.
You're mad.
Admit it, Rona. Admit
it. No.
Admit it.
Leave me alone. I want to go to bed.
Admit
to
that you've been deceiving me with Macy.
George, this has gone too far. All right, I'll go.
Tell me.
Yes. We're lovers, yes. Been lovers for 4 months.
So, like a blithering and sublime little idiot, she admitted it was all true. And after the initial outburst, Thring took it like a lamb. In reality, he must have been burning mad, a mass of white-hot revenge. Unbeknown to either Rona or Peter Macy, he plotted his revenge. And it must surely go down in the annals of affairs such as this as one of the most diabolical ever contemplated. Before the storm, fate played a hand. Macy went sick with malaria, really ill. And George Thring had to admit the necessity for Rona to nurse him practically night and day. Macy owed his recovery to her care, but even so, convalescence was a long job. In the end, Rona too crocked up through overwork, and Thring had them both on his hands. This was an opportunity better than he could have planned it. It separated the lovers and gave him complete control. The rains were over. The jungle had ceased wintering and spring was in the air. The young grass and vegetation were shooting into life, new life. Concurrently, all the creepy, crawly insect life of the jungle and plantation was young and vigorous and hungry too. These facts gave the husband a germ of an idea which he was not slow to perfect. An idea as devilish as man could devise. In Borneo, there is a kind of a mammoth earwig.
A thing as fine and gossamer as a spider's web. As long as a good-sized caterpillar.
And it lives on waxy secretions. These are integral parts of some flowers and trees and lie buried deep in their recesses.
It's one of the terrors of these tropics, because it moves and rests so lightly on a human being that one is practically unconscious of it. And, like its English relation, it has
a decided liking for the human ear. It was a terrible plan to put the giant earwig in Macy's hair just above the ear.
Once in his ear, it's a 1,000-to-1 chance against it ever coming out the same way. It would be impossible to turn. To back out would be an impossibility. And so, feeding as it goes, it would crawl right across inside the head.
The rains aren't coming back again, George, are they? I don't think I can bear it.
No, 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 no. That's just the old storm having a last blow. It's all over. It's spring now.
Oh.
Don't worry, sweetheart. It's all over. Oh, well, I must go and minister to our other patient. Don't you want to know how he is?
How is he today? He should be pretty well recovered by now.
Oh, he is. He is. Said only yesterday he can't wait to get back to work. I must admit I shall be glad. There's a lot of work he's doing right now. This is the year when all our pains are awarded.
I think I'll get up tomorrow, George. I can take some of the burden from you. Must have been awful for you having two invalids around the place.
Well, don't mention it. Those closest to me are sick. What am I to do?
Several days passed. Renathring began to nurse Macy in the last days of his recovery. It was late afternoon. Spring was really in, as they say. Borneo spring.
It'll be dark soon. Bats are about already. They're fruit bats, aren't they? I must light the lamps for you.
Tara, you care well for me, Rona. I wish I had you with me all the time.
Please, Peter, don't say anything else about all that. We must try and forget now, because...
But...
What's the matter? Peter, what is it?
My head! My ear! Merciful heavens, my ear!
That was the beginning. Rona did all she could, but there was nothing to see. Nothing to treat. Then for a while, Macy would be quiet, because the earwig was quiet. Then the vile thing would move or feed again, and... Spring came each day to Macy's bungalow. He was very helpful.
Here, drink this, old man. I think this is the best way to take the drug. It's foul without water.
Unbeknown to the wife, or the lover, of course, friend Thring had cast the dose of pain-relieving drug down the sink, and Macy was swallowing plain water.
This way it dissolves, and you can't even see it.
George, we've got to get a doctor.
I know, but... Well, you know how many miles that is away.
No, it's okay.
Wait,
it's just
come.
Migraine. When I was a child, I used to have headaches. Wait. The doctor's too far. Miles and miles away. It's impossible. There's too much work here.
George, we'll have to get the labor and we'll have to be carried down to the coast to the doctor.
Rona, come here a minute. Darling, we can't lose him. The malaria and this thing, he's not strong enough. Not yet. The moment he's gained a bit more strength, we will. But I promise you, it'd kill him if we took him now.
And so the work on the plantation went on. Rona nursed her former lover. Her husband went about the task of running the plantation. The laborers labored, the sun shone. And in the small darkened bungalow that was Macy's, its occupant lost weight and suffered the agonies of the damned. Gone now were all thoughts of love, illicit or otherwise. He could summon up no interest in the lovely golden-haired woman who was constantly by his side. The drugs were having an effect, because, of course, when she administered them, she did the job properly. Strangely enough, Macy didn't connect the relief he felt when Rona gave him his drugs to a complete failure of those drugs when the husband played nursemaid. During the days that passed, an awful lot of creepy crawlies down the plantation drainage system must have died. Their supply of painkilling medicine must have been near to running out, too, when the end came. Again, it was late afternoon. Dusk was just falling. Bats were flying about. And they were heavy with fruit returning home.
Too much. I can't take it any longer.
Both Thring and Rona were present. Macy must have suffered an excruciating pain, followed by a period of quiescence. Then,
Feeling a slight tickling sensation on his cheek, he put up his hand to rub or scratch. His fingers came into contact with the earwig and its fine gossamer hairs. He naturally was curious and looked to see what he was holding. Slowly, he realized.
What an escape! What an escape!
Only Thring kept quiet. And that, of course, was a mistake. This silence worried Macy, weak though he was. He looked from Rona to George Thring, and at the critical moment, George Thring could not meet his eyes. The truth was out. Macy threw the insect, now dead from the pressure of his fingers, from him, tried to rise, and then fell back. Slowly, George Thring walked to where the earwig had fallen, picked it up, and studiously examined it. And from his pocket, he produced a magnifying glass he used daily for the inspection and detection of leaf disease on certain plants. As Rona watched, she saw the fear and disappointment leave her husband's face to be replaced by a look of cunning and evil satisfaction. Then, for the first time, he spoke.
Macy.
Macy looked up. Thring held up the earwig.
This is dead now. As dead as my friendship for you. As dead as my love for that creature who was my wife. It's dead. Dead. But it's a female. Do you get me? This earwig's a female. And a female lays eggs. And before I put it in your hair, it was...
touched your drink, cook, old man.
Huh? Oh. Truth. But what? I mean...
Oh, there was nothing anyone could say or do. Friend Macy made to get up and then fainted. Rona ran screaming from the bungalow. Her husband followed, snatching as he went a long Borneo native's knife from the wall. He caught her and slashed her, marked her neck. She's got the scar to this day. I think I'll have another whiskey.
Macy, I mean, what...
Well, he died, of course. No doctor could operate. The thing had laid eggs in his brain. Thring was tried for his murder. The wife, Rona, told everything to the authorities, but nothing was believed, of course. I mean, the story could never have happened, could it? She's a pretty wretched creature today. Her husband is hopelessly insane, so they say. Anyway, he's in the lunatic asylum for life. So... there it is. A waiter. Two double whiskies and sodas, please.
Beyond Midnight is presented every Friday night at 9:30 by Biotex, the new soak and pre-wash powder. The program is adapted for broadcasting and produced by Michael McCabe.
Utterly scarifying. Well, it's just the whole series is good.
Yeah.
The whole Beyond Midnight series full of good scares.
So was the political situation in South Africa when it was being recorded. Lots of horror all around.
We have one more story of revenge in our revenge-themed evening of old-time radio.
The Bride Wore Black from the Cornell Woolrich story. And Cornell Woolrich, he wrote Rear Window. He wrote so many great stories, often with the word black in the title. The Black Curtain is a great one. He was his life was kind of a sad story, but the stories that he wrote were so amazing and compelling. He was adapted many times for radio and in the movies. And this story was adapted not only way back when, but this is the story Quentin Tarantino took this and freely adapted it to become Kill Bill Parts 1 and 2.
And it's the basis of the François Truffaut movie, The Bride Wore Black from 1968 with Jeanne Moreau.
Yeah. We actually, Jeff and I, did a production with Up Theater Company of The Bride Wore Black, and Max put it on this show. So it was on the Golden Age of Radio a couple of years ago. And we found that we had to make a couple of little adjustments to it, or we wanted to. We thought the story deserved it. And when we come back at the end of the show, we'll tell you what the little changes were that we made.
The Bride Wore Black, February 7th, 1947. Mole Mystery Theater on the Golden Age of Radio.
And now the Mole Mystery Theater, presented by M-O-L-L-E. Mole. The heavier brushless shaving cream for tough whiskers and a tender skin.
Beautiful. I'm going to make you happy, Nick. Really happy. I'm going to be a good wife, darling.
Nick! What's the matter? Nick, what's happened? Oh, no! Nick!
Good evening. This is Jeffrey Barnes welcoming you to the Mole Mystery Theater, the program that presents the best in mystery and detective fiction. You've just heard the opening scene of tonight's story by Cornell Woolrich, starring Miss June Havoc and bearing the rather unusual and bizarre title, The Bride Wore Black. After all, black is the color we associate with death and funerals, not with weddings and romance. But tonight, black is the color of a woman's revenge.
Well, gee, Mr. Barnes, you know, some men could cope with such a dangerous woman, and yet, strangely enough, be worried stiff when it comes to shaving tough whiskers or a tender skin. Well, men, we don't blame you. All we say is, try Mole, the heavier brushless shaving cream. Yes, sir, it's smooth. So smooth. It's slick. So slick. It's a smooth, smooth, slick, slick shave you get with M-O-L-L-E. Mole, the heavier brushless shaving cream for tough whiskers or a tender skin. Mole. Now for tonight's Mole Mystery presentation, The Bride Wore Black.
In the library of a suburban estate not far from New York City, a young and beautiful woman, her red hair drawn into a prim knot, sits typing. She does not look up as a tall, heavily built man enters the room and approaches her softly.
Almost finished the manuscript?
What? Oh, Mr. Holmes, I didn't hear you come in.
I asked. You almost done?
Well, not quite, Mr. Holmes. I still have a few more pages.
Well, let it go for now. I'd like to talk to you.
Talk?
Yes, a rather long talk. So why don't you take my armchair?
Oh, no, I couldn't, thank you.
I insist. I want you to sit there.
But I
insist on it.
Well, where will you sit?
I'll take your chair. Now, if you don't mind. There. Isn't that more comfortable?
I suppose so.
Now, just to make things a little cozier, suppose I put a little more wood on the fire.
Oh, no, it's too warm in here already.
Warm? I feel a chill. Let's see these two logs. Ah, look at them catch fire. Now, suppose I just turn on this recording machine.
Why, what for?
I want this little talk of ours recorded. You see, there's something I want to clear up between us.
Something you want to clear up?
Yes, Mrs. Killeen.
Mrs. Killeen?
Oh, I know that's not the name you gave me when you came to work as my secretary.
But it isn't my name.
I happen to know better. But let's not get off on any tangents. We both know who you are.
What on earth are
you? The one thing I don't know yet, the thing I'd like you to tell me now, is just how and when you intended to murder me.
Murder you? Why? Oh, you're joking. Why should I want to kill you?
I think that'll come out in our talk, Mrs. Killey.
Well, I don't
intend to... No, no, no. Sit right where you are. You're not going to get up out of that chair.
Well, you can't keep me here.
Yes, I can, and I will. I suppose you just listen to me, without interruptions.
But you have no
right... Without interruptions. I don't flatter myself. I wouldn't be the first man you murdered.
Oh, nonsense.
No, as a matter of fact, I was to be the last. But I want to go back to the first man, Ken Bliss. Bliss was at a party given in the penthouse of a friend of his named Corey when he noticed you.
Hey, Corey, come here a minute, will you? Come here.
What do you want, Ken?
Want to ask you something.
Uh-huh.
Who's that blonde dish over there in the corner, huh?
Which one?
The one in the black net dress.
Oh, yeah. Wonder what she's doing here.
Well, let's go over and find out. Well, come on, what are you waiting for, huh? Pardon me.
Yeah?
I brought our host over to introduce us to one another. Well, go on, Corey. Start hosting.
I'm not sure I remember the young lady's name.
Why, of course you do. It's Nora.
Nora? You sure?
Of course I am.
Oh, of course. Maybe I got you mixed up with someone else.
Uh-huh. Perhaps you have.
Perhaps. I don't know.
What is all this? I'm Ken Bliss.
How do you do?
Come on, Nora. Come out on the terrace. Huh?
Well,
I'll show you the city. All lit up.
All right.
Beautiful terrace. Beautiful terrace. Don't know how Corey can afford it, but there have been rumors.
Shut up, Ken.
Okay, Corey. Hey, coming, Nora?
Yes.
I'll come along.
Ah, you've got your guest.
I'll come along.
Ooh, chilly out here. Could you bring me my wrap?
Attaboy, Corey.
Would you, Mr. Corey?
Okay, I'll get your coat. Which one is it?
It's a blonde mink. Initials NR.
Right. I'll be back.
Don't seem so chilly out here to me.
It isn't. It's just that I wanted to talk to you, Mr. Bliss, alone.
Oh?
About something important.
Important? What's important?
You. Some things about you.
Yeah? What about me?
Oh, about the time we met once before.
We met? And I forgot.
Well, we didn't exactly meet. You saw me and
forgot
I...
you? Oh, no. Impossible.
You were in a car with three other men.
That could be 100 times.
But this time, the car's license number was D3827, remember?
No. I got a rotten head for figures. Besides, what's the difference? We're here and now.
This car was...
Forget the car.
It was kept in a garage up on Exterior Avenue in the Bronx, and they left it there. They never called for it again. But I traced it. I found out who was in it.
Look, who's interested in some car? I mean, a beautiful girl, and all she gives me is a routine about a car. Oh, no. Come here.
Well.
Now, let's just stay interested in us. You and me. And what's the matter?
My scarf. You knocked it off my shoulders.
You weren't wearing any scarf.
It flew over the railing.
You sure?
There it is. It's caught on something right down there. Well... Maybe I can reach it.
No. I'll do it. Here. Look out. Let me. Now, where is the thing, huh?
Right there. Don't you see it? Watch out. Don't lean over too far.
Oh, boy, it makes me dizzy. I don't see your scarf.
Right below you. A little further. A little more.
Now, what you doing?
Getting even for Nick Killeen.
Huh?
No.
No, don't! No!
When Corey came back, after searching for your non-existent coat, Mrs. Killeen, you were gone. You had killed your first man. Don't get up. Sit there. Right there. We still have a good deal to talk about. About Joe Mitchell, for instance. He lived in a cheap hotel on the West Side, lived a cheap, drab life, until that evening that he came back to the lobby.
Hello, Mr. Mitchell. Want your key?
Yeah, Tom. Oh, mail for me?
Yes, sir.
Let's see what we've got here. Advertisement. Here, you want to buy a custom-tailored suit?
No, thanks. I couldn't afford it.
Neither can I right now. Hey, you sure this one is for me?
Your name's on the envelope, isn't it?
Yeah, but a theater ticket. Elgin Theater, Box A, a 480 seat, and for tonight. Why should anyone send this to me?
I don't know, Mr. Mitchell. Were you ever connected with the theater?
Well, I used to tend bar where a lot of actors hung out. Maybe that's it. Maybe somebody remembered me. Well, it's a break. I might as well go. After all, what can I lose?
Hey, Tom, is that Mr. Mitchell?
Yeah, he's right here.
I got a call for him.
Oh, okay. You can take it here, Mr. Mitchell. Hello?
Joe? It's me, Maybelle.
Yeah? What do you want?
Well, what are you snapping for?
I'm not feeling so good.
It sounds all right.
Well, I don't feel good. Listen, I gotta hurry. Call me tomorrow, or I'll call you.
Well, you're going in such a hurry. I thought you said you're sick.
I am. I'm going to bed. I'm sorry about our date.
Don't be foolish, Joe. That's all right. I tell you what. I'll bring over some chicken soup.
No.
Get some nice warm chicken soup from the restaurant. The cook will give it to me.
No, no, I told you. Look, I gotta hang up. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Yeah, but Joey...
Chicken soup.
Oh, excuse me. Do you mind if I take this seat?
Why, no, not at all. Plenty of room. Oh, you're just in time. They're dimming the lights. Tell me, someone send you a ticket, too?
No, this is my box. But I must confess, I sent you your ticket.
You sent
me? Yes, I wanted to see you again.
Again? But I never saw
you. We can't talk here. I want to be alone with you.
Yeah, but the show's about... Well, why don't we go over to my place? It's a hotel, but it's respectable, sort of.
Well, I wouldn't want to be seen going to your room.
Oh, I understand. Well, we can go up the stairs. It's only the third floor, and no one will notice us. What do you say?
All right. That will be as good a place as any. Well, I can see by all the girls' pictures on the walls that you're really a ladies' man, aren't you?
Oh, those? No, they don't mean a thing. You know, I've always been looking for something, the right one, someone with class like you.
I can imagine.
No, this is no gag. I mean it. Just by being here, you make this room seem, well, I don't know how to say it, something wonderful. You give it a kind of feeling, you understand? It's like I'd arrived somewhere, somewhere I always wanted to go.
Maybe we can arrange that. Let's have a drink.
Oh, swell. I've got some rye here in the closet. Don't mind having it straight.
No. I can have mine with water.
If I'd known, I would have gotten something good.
This will serve its purpose. Turn on the radio. I'll pour it out.
Okay. Want anything special?
No. Just the music.
Ah, now for a drink.
Here's yours.
Okay. Here's to a long life and a merry one.
Yes, a long life.
Well, aren't you having any? What's the matter? It's not bad stuff.
I was just thinking.
Thinking? About what?
About our first meeting.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been wondering about that. Where did I ever see you before?
On the steps of a church.
On the steps of... Oh!
What's wrong?
That's funny. Nothing, just a pain in my stomach. Go away. What's this about you on the steps of a church?
I was getting married.
Married?
Don't you remember now?
No, I... Oh, it's the darnest slang all of a sudden, too.
No, enough of this radio.
It's burning.
Don't you remember the church, the wedding, and then right after...
Look, something's wrong. I gotta call a doctor.
No, you're not going to call a doctor.
What?
You're too late for a doctor.
Too late? What'd you do to me? I don't know you.
Yes, you know me. I'm Mrs. Nick Killeen.
Nick Killeen? I don't understand.
You don't remember Nick Killeen and the girl on the steps in her wedding dress? You don't remember that?
Well, Al, open the door and see.
My wedding day and you were there. You and three others.
Oh, you got me all mixed up. Alistair...
Joe, it's Maybelle. Open the door.
Just a minute. Yes, what do you want?
Oh, well, I don't want to barge in, but I got some chicken soup for Joe.
Listen, get out of here quick. Make sure people see you leaving and take that jar of soup with you.
Why, what's the matter?
Do as I say. I don't want you to get into any trouble. I don't have anything against you.
You must be nuts.
All right, go on in and have a good look.
Oh.
beloved was murdered on their wedding day, in blind rage, has vowed to avenge him. One of her intended victims, however, has uncovered her whole plot.
That, Mrs. Killeen, was how you murdered Ken Bliss and Joe Mitchell. The first, you pushed from the terrace of Corey's apartment.
No, I didn't.
The second, you poisoned in his hotel room. Now you can see why I wanted this recorded.
Mr. Holmes, you know this is a pack of lies. You know it's not true.
On the contrary, every word of what I've said is gospel. No, don't get up. Now I'll go over what happened to Frank Moran. I said don't get up. Sit there and listen. We begin in the street, outside Frank Moran's house in Scarsdale. A 5-year-old boy riding a tricycle is stopped by an attractive young woman.
Hey, you got in my way. You got in my way.
Oh, I'm sorry, but I found this ball. Is it your ball?
No. Mine's a high bouncer.
Oh, do you want this one? I'll give it to you.
Gee, thanks.
What's your name?
Cookie Moran.
And what's your father's name?
He's Mr. Frank Moran.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
No, but I got a grandma, though. She lives in Garrison, but she comes to stay with us.
Well, don't you ever go to Garrison to visit her?
Oh, yeah. But Dr. Bixby says I make too much noise for Grandma. She's sick.
Oh, Dr. Bixby's your grandma's doctor, hmm?
Sure. He goes to see her lot. My Aunt Ada takes care of her.
Tell me, have you started school yet?
Oh, sure. I go to kindergarten every day.
What do you do there?
We draw ducks and rabbits, and Miss Baker gave me a gold star for drawing a cow. I brought it home.
Really? Well, you run along and play now, Cookie. And don't lose the ball. Frank! Frank!
What is it, dear?
A telegram for my sister Ada. Mother's very sick. She had a stroke.
A stroke?
Dr. Bixby wants me to come to Garrison right away.
Well, you'd better go. I'll drive you to the station.
No, I'll take a cab. You stay here with Cookie and Frank. Don't let him get into any trouble while I'm gone.
Hello?
Hello, Mr. Moran.
Yes?
This is Miss Baker, Cookie's kindergarten teacher.
Yes.
I've heard Mrs. Moran had to go away, and I've been worried about Cookie. You know, he's so active. I'd like to come over this evening and help you take care of him.
Well, certainly, Miss Baker, and thank you for being so thoughtful.
You're not Miss Baker.
What?
You're not.
What?
You're the lady on the street.
No, Cookie.
My son, that's not the way to talk.
It's nothing to be alarmed about, Mr. Moran. It's just that he's very imaginative.
What's the matter with you, Cookie? I thought you liked Miss Baker.
She isn't Miss Baker.
Let me handle him. I'm used to this. Now, Cookie, didn't I just give you a gold star the other day for drawing a cow?
Huh?
And didn't I tell you I was going to see your parents someday and tell them how good you are in school?
Did you?
You know I did.
Well, if you're Miss Baker, how come you don't look like Miss Baker?
That's because I'm not wearing my glasses. You see, Mr. Moran, there's a fine point of child psychology involved here.
Mm.
Cookie's used to seeing me in the kindergarten and not in his home.
Of course.
But now that he's getting used to me here, I think he's beginning to recognize me. Aren't you, Cookie?
Yes, Miss Baker.
Yeah, that's better. Now, how would you like to show me this?
Here's a closet under the stairs. I used to hide in here when I played hide and seek. See, now I can't.
Why not?
Daddy won't let me. He says there's no air in there. Mm-hmm. Look, I'll show you. I'll crawl in. There's nothing in here, just me.
Mr. Moran!
Yes?
Come here, please.
What is it, Miss Baker? What's happened?
Well, Cookie's locked in the closet, and I can't get the door open.
Now, don't get frightened. There's nothing to it. It can't be opened from the inside, but all we have to do is unlatch it like this, and the door comes open.
Oh.
All right, Cookie, come on out.
It was dark in there. I couldn't see anything at all.
Well, you get upstairs and go to bed.
No, Daddy.
It's getting late.
I don't want to. I'm having fun.
Now, you heard me.
Well, all right, but it's still early. Good night.
Oh, that gave me a fright. He's getting locked in there.
I know.
I was afraid the door had jammed.
I don't let Cookie go in here. The door's solid oak, about 2 inches thick, and there's hardly any space at all.
Yes, it is small. How long do you suppose a person would last if he got caught in there?
Oh, I don't know. An hour or two at the most. The closet's airtight, and I don't...
Oh, my goodness.
What is something the matter?
Oh, my bracelet.
Your bracelet.
Cookie had it, and he must have left it in that closet.
Oh, well, I'll get it.
I'll just feel around here, and I'm sure I'll find it for you. Just hold the door open, will you?
Frank Moran.
What? Did you say something?
This is for Nick Killeen.
Ever be forgotten, Mrs. Killeen, by the widow of Frank Moran, or by that little boy?
Why, you must be out of your mind, Mr. Holmes, making these accusations against me.
I assure you, I'm entirely sane. You see, Mrs. Killeen, I've been on to you right from the beginning, from the moment you wangled an introduction to me through my publisher, from the moment you came here to work as my secretary. As a matter of fact, Mrs. Killeen, I've been waiting for you.
Waiting for me?
Yes, ever since I put it together, the connection between Bliss, Mitchell, Moran, and now Holmes. The auto ride following a drunken party, the wedding at the church, the murder.
What?
Well, what's the matter?
It's getting too warm here. Is this chair?
I don't think you're too warm.
I'm too close to the fire.
No. Why, your hands are ice cold. You're trembling.
Let me go. Let me up.
No, stay there. I want you to stay there in my chair.
No, I can't.
Why?
Please, please let me go.
Why? Why can't you stay in that chair? Why can't you stay near the fireplace? Tell me, why?
There's a shotgun loaded behind the zinc partition. The heat of the fire.
Yes? You said it to kill me?
Yes, I was going to kill you.
All right, Mrs. Killeen, you can get up now. You don't have to hurry. I found the gun this morning and took out the charge. I think we have enough on the recorder. Mrs. Killeen, you were wrong on 3 counts. About the gun, about the way your husband was killed, and one more thing. About me.
About you?
Yes.
What about you?
I'm not George Holmes.
Not George?
I've just been substituting for him.
Substituting? Who are you?
I'm Lieutenant Wanger, New York City Police. Mrs. Killeen, I put you under arrest for the murders of Ken Bliss, Joe Mitchell, Frank Moran, and the attempted murder of George Holmes, although I don't think we'll even bother about that.
This is Jeffrey Barnes again. In just a moment, we'll bring you Act 3 of The Bride Wore Black. Now, a word from Ron Rawson.
One thing to remember about the most common type of dandruff is that many outstanding authorities say it is not a natural condition, but actually is caused by a germ called Pityrosporum ovale. Now, the only way you can get real relief is to destroy this germ. And simply washing or brushing away loose dandruff won't do it. But double dandrine will. Yes, double dandrine really works because it gets at the cause of this dandruff and kills it. Actually kills the germ on contact. Results with double dandrine have been remarkable, even in many stubborn cases. And the thing that makes double dandrine so amazingly effective is a special ingredient. An active antiseptic that's so wonderfully efficient many hospitals use it. In double dandrine, we call it Alzan. So stop trying to combat this dandruff with ineffective methods that actually are no better than plain water. Use double dandrine and destroy the cause. Get double dandrine tomorrow. Your money back if not satisfied.
Yes?
Mrs. Killeen out here for you, Lieutenant.
Okay, bring her in. All right, Marty, wait outside.
Yes, sir.
Sit down, won't you, Mrs. Killeen? I hope you weren't too uncomfortable last night.
Bad enough without your sarcasm.
Oh, I'm quite sincere. You see, I realize your motive in this whole series of murders. Revenge. Well, I suppose that's a motive anyone can understand, but not condone. And in this case, Mrs. Killeen, you killed 3 innocent men.
How can you say that? They murdered Nick. Killed him in cold blood right on the steps of the church.
They didn't kill him.
Yes, they did.
Let me reconstruct what happened on that day. The wedding was over. You came out of the church, you and Nick, your bridesmaid, the others. And suddenly a car rounded the corner at high speed, came toward the church. There was a series of sounds, like backfire. And then... Get the girls out of
here. Please, get up, Nick.
You'd better come with me, Julie.
Please, Julie, you're getting blood on your dress.
Let me handle it.
No, I don't need any help. Andrea.
Yes, dear.
Did you see that car?
Yes.
Come on, Julie.
No.
No, Andrea, did you get a good look?
Yes, I did.
How many men were in that car?
There were four of them, but I...
Did you see the license number?
It was D-38-27.
I'll remember that. Come with me, please, Andrea. I'm going back inside the church.
Pray?
No. To make a vow. Another vow to Nick.
That's what happened on the steps of the church, isn't it, Mrs. Killeen?
Yes.
You made one mistake, a tragic mistake. Those men in the car, they had nothing to do with your husband's death.
They did. They killed
him. No. On that day that Bliss and Mitchell and Moran and Holmes tore past the church steps in their car, another man crouched at a window of a rooming house opposite, a gun in his hand, waiting for Nick Killeen.
Ooh.
He raised his gun as you came out on the steps. As the car streaked by, its exhaust backfiring, he shot.
Who was it?
Just a moment.
Yes, Lieutenant?
Bring him in.
Okay, sir.
He was a former partner of Nick's. The man who worked the rackets with him. The man who couldn't let Nick go straight.
Oh, stop torturing me. Who was it?
Good morning.
Oh, no. It can't be.
How do you do, Mrs. Killeen?
Corey.
Yeah, when you came to my party, I thought I recognized you from a picture Nick showed me once.
And I sent you away so I could kill Bliss.
Yeah. Wasn't it too bad you didn't know who I was? Too bad Nick wouldn't introduce you to his partner. He didn't even trust me to meet you. And now look at the mess you're in.
You're on a spot yourself, Corey.
Sure, I know that. You know...
Yes?
Wouldn't it be something if me and her were hung the same day?
Now, this is Jeffrey Barnes again, inviting you to join us next week when we present a great tale from the pen of Vincent Starrett entitled The 11th Juror, which will star Sidney Blackmer, popular star of stage and screen.
Original music for the Mystery Theater is composed and conducted by Alexander Semler. Any similarity between the names and characters used on this show and any actual persons, living or dead, is purely coincidental. Tonight's play was adapted for radio by Paul Monash. This is Dan Seymour saying goodnight until next Friday at this same time when the Mystery Theater presents The 11th Juror.
This is NBC, the national broadcasting company.
That was The Bride Wore Black, starring June Havoc, from February 7th, 1947.
Baby June.
When we made our own version of The Bride Wore Black a couple years ago with Up Theater Company, one of the things that really bothered us was that you follow the bride the whole time, and then in this version that we just listened to on Mole Mystery Theater, they actually give the last line of the show to this nobody. The kind of, I mean, he's the villain, I guess, but he's also,
he's a rando.
He's not really in the script at all. They give him the thing to say. She deserves the last line. So we were able to rejigger the story a little bit just to give her the same sentiment so that she could have the last cruel line at the end of the show, as she deserves to have. Well, that's a lot of revenge for one night, Jeff.
A lot of spite, a lot of payback.
Thank you for listening. Next week, Max Schmidt is going to be back with more Golden Age of Radio here on WBAI New York.
Thank you, boys. Thank you. Another fine job from the resident producers. Heard approximately once a month here on the Golden Age of Radio, WBAI New York. And happy anniversary to Doug and Carolyn. Celebrating many, many happy years together. And, yeah, I guess I'll be back next week. Do I have to? All right. Well, we will.
This is the mic check for Cat Radio Cafe.
Testing.
Testing.
Tune into Cat Radio Cafe Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
I'm Janet Coleman.
I'm David Dozer.
Displaced Playwright on Tuesday, September 26th at 9 p.m. We'll be joined by author and musical theater expert Ethan Morden to discuss his latest book, Gays on Broadway, which chronicles the plays and people that brought gay culture to Broadway.
Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Did the cats drink coffee?
Schubert Alley Cats.
Oh, that's what I thought.